The Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor speaks of taking refuge in the three treasures. So this is a Zen take on taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Huineng, the Sixth Ancestor, says, "Good friends, I urge you to take refuge in the three treasures in your own nature." So it's an internal refuge as opposed to an external refuge. I urge you to take refuge in the three treasures of your own nature. The Buddha is enlightenment, the Dharma is truth, and the Sangha is purity. If in your minds you take refuge in enlightenment, or Buddha, heretical views and delusions are not produced. You have no desires and are content with yourself as you are and stand apart from cravings and physical wants. Therefore, Buddha is called most honored among two-legged beings," which is one of Dogen's. I think it's just an old way of talking about Buddha, most honored among bipeds. But this is like, this refuge in Buddha is in your own minds, taking refuge in Buddha, then there's no delusion, there's no greed, hate, and delusion, we might say. If in your own mind you rely on truth or Dharma, then because there's no falseness in successive thoughts, there will be no attachment. Since there's no attachment, the Dharma is called the most noble teaching, which sets people free from desire. So, in your own nature, no attachment to phenomena of the external world. If in your own mind you rely on purity or Sangha, although all the desires and false thoughts are within your own natures, your nature is not stained by them. Therefore, the Sangha is called most honored among sentient beings. So, yeah, it's interesting. These three word version of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is enlightenment, truth, and purity. In Dogen's version, way back we talked about how one of Dogen's versions of Dharma is purity. Dharma is the purity from delusion. But Sangha as purity is interesting, yeah. It's a new one, yeah.
So Dogen's purity was non-duality.
Yeah, I think that's how I would understand.
And how is it?
Sangha.
Sangha purity?
If in your own mind you rely on purity, Sangha, although all desires and false thoughts are within your own natures, your natures are not stained by those. So it is a kind of a non-duality thing, too, it sounds like. Although all the greed, hate, and delusion are in ourselves, our true nature is actually not stained or defiled by them. That's how I hear it. The purity doesn't, in this case, sounds like it doesn't mean eliminating greed, hate, and delusion. It's taking refuge in our true nature that's actually not stained by greed, hate, and delusion, even though they're appearing there. You could say our Buddha nature is in itself inherently and beginninglessly free from greed, hate, and delusion. But greed, hate, and delusion still appear according to conditions and cause us all kinds of suffering. But the refuge in Sangha here is the refuge in the true nature that's free from greed, hate, and delusion. So it is funny that it's kind of connected with Sangha.
Yeah, I wonder whether it's a different notion of Sangha than we're familiar with.
I think it's this, you know, classic thing of Sangha, but Dogen's version and other versions do talk about Sangha as harmony, the harmony of not just people even, but we could say all things. Mm. Maybe the interdependent, harmonious activity of all things, but maybe more specifically or traditionally, we could say the community that's living in harmony. And but here, I think we could take it as a practice instruction to take refuge in the Sangha, not just of ourselves, but in our nature, but we could say the nature of everyone that we're practicing with.
That's what I was going to say. It's sort of like the first one, taking refuge in Buddha, but we're just doing it with everybody else.
Yeah.
Sangha.
Like the Buddha nature of our own nature.
Right.
And then the Sangha, you could say, we're taking refuge in the true nature of everyone we're practicing with. That actually often looks like greed, hate, and delusion we see in others, but we're taking refuge in the purity, free from greed, hate, and delusion in others. So I think that is maybe a helpful way to take refuge in our practice companions, right? Is like, well, how can I take refuge in these people if they seem to be caught up in the kleshas of greed, hate, and delusion? Well, we're taking refuge in their true nature that is unstained. Yeah, their nature is unstained by the greed, hate, and delusion. That's the purity of our practice friends. So it sounds like maybe that's what he's actually pointing to with Sangha here. Yes.
Any comment on nature versus mind/what mind he's talking about? Like body mind, Buddha nature mind, mind mind, or what?
The beginning where he says, if in your own minds you take refuge in enlightenment, truth, and purity.
I thought he said at one point that is the mind too, but I might be confusing it with the Bodhidharma.
Oh, uh-huh. I think mind generally means like big mind for the sixth ancestor. And nature, he uses this word nature all throughout the Platform Sutra. It's almost like maybe one of the trademark words in the Platform Sutra is nature. And I think I would understand it as short for Buddha nature, but also short for Dharma nature, which is like Dharmata is the true nature of all phenomena. And we could say Buddha nature is the true nature of awareness or mind. We could say Buddha nature is the true nature, the reality of mind, and Dharma nature is the reality of phenomena.
For me, that's what it is. Those refuges are what I think about. You know, for me, it may be because I read that book, the Path to Sutra,
mm-hmm.
a long time ago, and it just resonated with me. That's how I look at it. I know we've gone through different styles, but that's how I look at it.
Yeah, and I think that's similar to Dogen's, like, one body, triple treasure. Pretty much the same, I would say. It's different wording, but the kind of ultimate Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as this purity and inherent awakeness, mm-hmm. and then we also, these different versions of three treasures also can take refuge in these, you know, these manifestations of how does that look in the world. It looks like, benefiting beings, and it looks like these sutras that appear in words and people practicing Buddha's way and so on.
And that nature, I think, for me, is more like I'd have to say it's kind of like a faith that there is that something exists in that state of nature, you know, pure nature or Buddha nature, and that, and I've come to realize it in my mind that, it's that, that the removal of those hindrances lead me to that area.
Yeah, true nature.
That feeling of being like, I always say grounded or, you know, but that just seems like there is a kind of a human nature or Buddha nature, you know, that just kind of resonates and is free.
Yeah, and I think it's true. We can have faith in it, and then we can like we can tap into it, actually. We can fully appreciate it. In Zazen, sometimes we might be sitting in a way where it's like we're really not grasping anything, and actually taste like this freedom. Like we might ask ourselves in deeply settled Zazen, well, is there any like greed, hate, and delusion here? And like, can't find any. How's it going? Quite well, you know. And actually, this is not just a random state because the temperature's just right and my body's very comfortable. It's actually because there's no grasping anything. And then we might even say, this is my refuge, this Zazen awareness, this Zazen way of being. I can take refuge in this as my practice direction. And I also have the sense that even though I'm not even aware maybe of other beings at this time because there's nothing happening, I have a trust that in this grasping-free realm, that this is great benefit to others too. If I can live in this Zazen mind, it would be great for me and great for everybody else. Therefore, I take refuge.
Yes, when I sat today, my hindrance was heat. It was hot. Mm-hmm. And I started sweating. And I really, you know, I thought, well, you know, if I could just be with the heat, then I could be close. You know, I didn't say closer to my Buddha nature, but that's kind of what I'm thinking. You know, like, I could just be, you know, hot. You
mm-hmm.
know?
Yeah.
Just, you know, be there, and then I wouldn't have to suffer with it and look at the temperature or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, or we say, like Dongshan says, the place where we get free from hot and cold is to be killed by the heat and killed by the cold.
I just happened to read a comment by Sukhayan.
Oh, yes.
On Hui Nung, who says the word nature. Actually, it's a little puzzling, I'm not quite sure how to grasp it, but he said that Hui Nung's use of this word nature is a particular to Hui Nung,
is particular to him?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and unique to him in the way that he uses it and understood it, and it had to do something like the actual felt experiential-ness of being in touch with that absolute non-dual nature of yourself and things.
That sounds just right. Yeah, yeah.
But mm-hmm. he made a point that nature that we know I'm talking about was about it being directly experienced and felt by a person in order for it to be genuine.
Mm-hmm. And then in Bodhidharma has this phrase about the separate transmission outside the sutras, directly pointing to the human mind, seeing nature and becoming Buddha. So that kensho shobutsu, see your nature and become Buddha. And that phrase became very popular, and the sixth ancestor picked up on that. So as you may know, you know, in Rinzai Zen, kensho is the big word.
In fact, I think that you tie it, in fact, to the koan before mother and father. What is your aspect? And he said that until that's realized, you can't see what nature you're referring to.
Yeah. So see, I have heard it said that this nature is kind of like short for Buddha nature. See your nature, your true nature. But the Platform Sutras, he leaves out the Buddha, and it's constantly saying, you have to see your own nature. So this term kensho is just like, must be 100 times in the Platform Sutra, kensho, which means literally seeing your nature. So when you say directly experience, I think it's seeing. Now Dogen was kind of critical of this term kensho, because it could be interpreted to be slightly dualistic, because, well, who is seeing something? The word seeing kind of implies there's something to be seen. I don't think that's the, you know, actual meaning of the sixth ancestor, but it could, I think that's why Dogen critiques that term a little bit, because it's not so much a matter of seeing something, and we could get caught up in trying to see something rather than actually just being nature.
What I'm saying that was that Dogen just thought that Kensho was nothing special, and people may revere kind of that idea of Kensho, like it's too much emphasis on that, that specialness about seeing something. It's like, it's not a big deal, just move on into the next thing. That's what I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't have named you after it then. It's such a big deal.
I mean, saying that it's nothing special is sort of paradoxical, because, you know, it's not saying that it's nothing, or, you know, or inconsequential. Or
I didn't say that. That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah,
I'm just saying that it's not like paranormal. It's not. It's just our nature. We see our nature and.
We don't want to grasp it, as something, and yet, it's outside of it, projecting that it's something very special, kind of prevents it, because we're looking for something special where it's very simple, or sometimes called ordinary mind, and yet on the other side. To say, well, it's just, I guess it's like here right now, like whatever, then we're also, that's maybe the other extreme, and then we're not honoring the fact that it's completely turning, overturns our whole
revolutionary,
at the same time as being totally normal, or, you know, in a way, unextraordinary. It's the pivotal shift.
Yeah,
From relating to our experience in this grasping way to freedom of no self and other.
Yeah.
According to Sok Khe An in that same commentary, he made a point that once that turning, you know, once made, is permanent. You know, when it's truly made, there's no going back from that.
That's an interesting issue, and Dogen's got this fascicle called Daigo, Great Enlightenment, Great Awakening, where that's one of the main themes in there, as I recall, is does or can an awakened person ever return to delusion? It's one of the themes that is explored, which of course is not a black and white thing. We have to really understand what this means, what would enlightenment be, and what would returning to delusion be. And of course Dogen approaches this in a very non-dual kind of way. If we equate it with the traditional Mahayana, and both early foundational Buddhist and Mahayana paths, they both speak of these pivotal moments called Darshana Marga, or the path of seeing. Interestingly, darshana, seeing, it maybe can be translated as ken, which is ken. Oh, that's why you're saying the name.
Yeah,
ken.
Yeah,
I got it. Ken, which means seeing.
The true ken wouldn't sweat, by the way.
Yeah. It's not Ken Cho, it's Ken.
But this darshana marga is this kind of path of no return. The way it's usually presented is you've seen so clearly and directly that, and you know it so deeply. It's not an intellectual knowing, and it's nothing that could be refuted or ever doubted again. It's the end of doubt about our true nature. And that's how that's presented, and still not the end of the path, interestingly.
No.
Then there's a lot of this integration. So you could say, It's never lost in the sense that we can't find it again, but it is lost in the sense of it gets forgotten. Our habits get so strong. That's how I understand this traditional path. Temporarily forgotten in a moment of anger or something. And that's why there's this long path after the path of seeing. That's this integration of anger arises due to, you know, eons of karmic habituation towards this, but But one way that Tenshin Roshi sometimes talks about this is like, it's as if, it's like anger arises, but for this bodhisattva on the, after the path of seeing, it's like, they see that this doesn't make sense. Part of their mind is like, in the anger, and part of it's saying, this is strange. This is not in accord with reality. They kind of know that, whereas before that they maybe think, this is in accord with reality and that's justified and I should be angry.
Grabbed by the anger.
Yeah, and it's more like there's no way to be free from it. But there's this, after this we could see, we know there's a way to be free, but we're actually still like caught.
Yeah.
Maybe not caught as much, but somewhat caught. And then there's a final, the path of so-called no more learning, which was mentioned earlier in this essay, would be like when you're never caught anymore. Like that's like Buddhahood. Maybe hard to imagine.
There's a time I remember like, if I was angry, I would get caught by the anger, and I went with that anger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, more so, it's like, you know, if I get angry, I kind of say, hey, you know, what is that about? Like, I kind of, like, you know, I can sometimes get, like, quickly angry. And I was like, well, that's kind of strange. Like, what am I going to, you know, shit about that? You know, like, at least I do it. It doesn't mean that I always, like, you know, do something well with it or do something skillful. But I'm aware of it more than just because of that. Because of the practice of, you know.
Yeah, we can become more and more aware of it. And then there's this, and then there's this pivotal moment where knowing of our true nature is no longer based on faith. It's like we've directly realized it. And because if it's based on faith, we could hear some other teaching that could be like kind of steer us, well, maybe it's more like this and that. So sometimes it's said when these three refuges in Buddha are really complete, they're no longer based on a kind of like hope that they're the supreme security, but more like knowing that they really are.
Yeah, I mean, faith for me is, like he was saying, experiential. I remember Rono Gui, when I first started practicing, he talked about Buddhism as an inside job working outward. And, you know, other religions oftentimes are outside coming in. He's there, so this experiential thing really grasped, you know, caught me.
Yeah.
And so as I experience some things in practice, it builds confidence, which increases the faith. You know, like in the beginning, I don't know, like, but I sat one time, I felt grounded. So that gave me faith that I should sit again, you know, and then I heard something, and then, oh, that rang fit. So that, you know, so it increased the faith.
It does build gradually.
It builds because
of
confidence I develop because of the experience, not because I believe that this and I'm trying to match this sutra.
I would almost say confidence and faith could even be synonyms, actually.
Yeah, like
the Chinese character for faith can also be translated as trust or even confidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think so. It's kind of like, you know, knowing that something is so.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, as opposed to belief in an idea would be a little bit different.
Yeah, right?
Belief. In the English language, belief and confidence sound quite different, actually, right? So, Sixth Ancestor also says about refuge. We might say this is more about the Buddha refuge, but he doesn't mention three refuges, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, but he says, good friends, you must all, with your own bodies, receive the precepts of formlessness and recite in unison what I am about to say. It will make you see the threefold body of Buddha in your own selves. And it's almost like, repeat after me, it's like a little precept ceremony, a refuge-taking ceremony. I take refuge in the pure Dharmakaya Buddha in my own physical body. I take refuge in the 10,000, 100 billion Nirmanakaya Buddhas in my own physical body. I take refuge in the future perfect Sambhogakaya Buddha in my own physical body. So that's another version that's not exactly Buddha Dharma Sangha, but he's using this traditional way of taking refuge, but it's in the three Buddha bodies, the Dharmakaya, which elsewhere in the Platform Sutra, Huineng defines these more as like the nature of mind, I think is how he talks about the Dharmakaya Buddha and the Sambhogakaya is when it's manifesting in a beneficial way, and Nirmanakaya is manifesting in maybe any old way, something like that. I can't remember exactly how he talks about it. But in a way, we could say that's the refuge in Buddha, three Buddha bodies, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. So that's all in there too. And I think this was, you know, early Tibetan Buddhism. Dzogchen was arising around the same time as the sixth ancestor in Tibet and this kind of Western China. And the Dzogchen tradition also has this, they have refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, in the usual way we would think of it, but they also have refuge in these three kayas, these three Buddha bodies, as a kind of like, I think they talk about like an inner refuge, or a kind of Dzogchen style of refuge. So I think that's interesting that it correlates with the Platform Sutra. Somebody will probably discover all these early links where they were all, a lot of those teachings began in the same time and place and then diverged. And at the full moon ceremony the other day, I read the comment of Dogen from the Kyoju Kaimon, and the line struck me about the, actually not Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but the 10th grave precept of not disparaging the three treasures. So a disciple of Buddha does not disparage the three treasures. And then Dogen's comment is, the body is manifested, the Dharma is enacted, and there is a bridge in the world for crossing over. The body is manifested, the Dharma is enacted, and there's a bridge in the world for crossing over. And I think I hear that as a comment on the three treasures, not disparaging the three treasures, but this is kind of what they are, why we don't disparage them, because the body is manifested, which sounds like the Buddha body. The Dharmakaya, formless body, is manifested as a Nirmanakaya. The Dharma is enacted, maybe every moment the Dharma is being enacted. And the Sangha, that particularly strikes me as a nice description of Sangha, is a bridge in the world for crossing over. In the world, in our world, beyond, you know, not just the formless Dharmakaya, but in our world, there's a bridge for crossing over from suffering to the shore of freedom, and that's called Sangha. Sangha is like our bridge in the world. It's a beautiful image for practicing with others.
I really like the way he puts that too, like, he doesn't name the bridge.
Yeah.
But it's just a really nice way to put it. But you know what, you obviously know from the context, but...
Yeah, I mean, you have maybe it took me a few times to actually hear that comment of Dogen and be, oh, those are the three treasures, because he doesn't say Sangha is a bridge in the world, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't limit the Sangha to the people in this room or in the monastery. It's more like the support that you had written in.
Support, is a way I've been thinking about Sangha.
Wherever that might be for you.
Yeah.
Like a bridge over troubled waters, I will lay me down.
Good song.
That's the Sangha vow, right? The Bodhisattva vow is actually, it kind of has that spirit. And then here in being upright, taking refuge in Buddha, Tenshin Roshi says, Ken brought this up a little bit in the previous week about being yourself. In the beginning here he says, to take refuge in Buddha means to take refuge in what you really are. What you really are is already attained always, every moment. What you really are is Buddha. You don't have to work at what you are. Part of what you are is what you think you are, but what you think you are is not all of what you are. It's just an aspect of what you are. Being Buddha means being unattached to your thoughts about what you are. If you think you're a worthy person or an unworthy person, not grasping those thoughts is Buddha. But in fact, being a person who has such thoughts is necessary condition for realizing Buddha. Yeah. So what you really are, we could hear this as our true nature, is what we really are, and that what we take refuge in, and that's already attained always, every moment, and that's Buddha, and you don't have to work at that part. And it's part of what we are is what we think we are, but that's not like our true nature. What you think you are is not all of what you are. And then being unattached to your thoughts about what you are would be like there's a true nature that's free from our thoughts about ourselves, and therefore we can have thoughts about ourselves. This is kind of part of what we are in the larger sense, but not being attached to those because we know they don't really reach who we truly are is taking refuge in Buddha. Yeah.
I think we're problematic too, where you sort of jump back to your story, it's none of your business.
Yeah, your life. Your life is none of your business.
Your life is none of your business. Oh, wow, I could let go of that.
Yeah. That's right. You could say that's the thoughts about who we are. That's none of our business. Our business is like our true nature's business. Isn't you so concerned with like exactly what's going on in our life? That's kind of the outer, that's the manifestation. And of course, we want that to be in harmony with everyone and beneficial in the world. But strictly speaking, it's not really our true business. Business is a nice word too, right? Because it means busyness. So that our true self is the one who's not busy. So here in Dogen's essay, we're up to about 2/3 of the way down on page 2, the Ekota Agama Sutra, which is the Sanskrit version of Anguttara Nikaya.
Did you have an extra copy for?
Yeah. Near the bottom of page 2. Ekota Agama. Ekota Agama Sutra.
We're going to have a class on that next time.
Yes.
It's like, it's part of the, what we think of as the Pali Canon now. It's the Sanskrit version of Pali Canon. So it's pre Mahayana Sutra. Maybe good to know that much. It's foundational sutras. The king of Tushita heaven showed the 5 signs of decay and was about to be reborn as a boar. A pig, it's kind of like a boar, right? And a note says, the 5 signs of decay, for basically we're talking about devas, the gods. Now, from now on in this essay, as if you've read ahead, you see now we're hearing all these kind of like Indian kind of mythological, far out stories, right, that you hear in the sutras. So the devas have these 5 signs of decay after their many thousands of year lifetime, and they start to finally get old. The 5 signs are their clothing starts to become kind of worn out and dirty, and their hair flowers that adorn the gods start to wither and fall and fade, and their body loses its radiant deva glow and starts to smell. That's the 3rd. The 4th sign is their armpits start to sweat. And the 5th sign is that their total enjoyment of the god realm starts to kind of fade, and they start to get maybe like kind of bored. Like, I've been enjoying this for like thousands and thousands of years, and like, you know, it's getting kind of old. Everything's kind of fading. So the king of Tushita heaven started experiencing these five signs of decay, like his life was going to end, and somehow he knew, because devas can have these divine powers and visions, even if they don't actually realize awakening, they can have these kind of magical powers. So he could tell he was going to die and be reborn in this animal realm. And Indra, the lord of the gods, in one of the, you know, up in the Deva realms, heard his desperate voice call to him and said, you know, Tushita, heaven king, you should take refuge in the three treasures. And the king followed his teaching and escaped being reborn as a boar. And then Shakyamuni Buddha said in a verse, I guess Shakyamuni is recounting this conversation in the Deva realms, and his Buddha says, by taking refuge in Buddha, beings will not fall into the three unwholesome realms. Free from desire, abiding in human or Deva realms, they will reach nirvana. So the three unwholesome or lower realms are the, you know, hell realms, the hungry ghost realms, and the animal realms, right? And the upper realms are the human realm, human and Deva god realms, and sometimes they add in these kind of like fighting gods, almost gods, that are like wanting to get into the final god realm, but they're also considered kind of higher realm actually, because they're close. And so the teaching here is that taking refuge in Buddha, in three treasures, one will no longer fall into these lower realms. And you hear that all through the sutras. And we might say, well, this is just old Buddhist cosmology. What does it mean to us? I think it's still a pertinent teaching, but how I understand it is, we may take these three realms literally, but we can also take them psychologically. And so each of the six realms is connected with a particular klesha, right, or afflicted emotion. So hell is connected with hate or anger. And the descriptions of hell is, you know, it's extremely hot or extremely cold, which are these feelings of rage. Cold is like totally separate, in a frozen wasteland, completely separate from beings due to our anger and righteousness, maybe. And or hot hell of burning fire is maybe what anger feels like. The hungry ghost realm is greed or craving. And the animal realm is like confusion or delusion. Animals are, they, you know, don't have the faculties of the upper realms to know what's going on. They're kind of, even dogs and cats, and often like they're pretty confused about what's going on if you like compare them to even a very dense person. So greed, hate, and delusion are kind of personified as hungry ghosts, hell, and animal realms. And then the upper realms, they're not greed, hate, and delusion aren't the dominant, but maybe human realm is like in a way all, there's sort of a nice blend of greed, hate, and delusion. And if we want to make a nice list of six kleshas, we could say doubt. Humans, because we have this conceptual thinking, we can have doubts that other realms maybe don't have. And of course the jealous, angry gods trying to be gods is jealousy, and gods is pride. we're like, we made it to the top, the Deva realm, but we're proud of it. So each of the six is part of samsaric suffering. But there is this teaching that taking refuge in Buddha, we're no longer born in these realms of, I would think of it for us as like extreme hatred, right? Would be like a hell realm. Extreme craving and greed, desperate, and unsatisfied, right? And extreme animal-like delusion and confusion. And I think there actually is some truth to that. If we actually take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, sincerely, like, trust in our awakened nature and the truth of how things are and the harmony of all beings, for example, over and over, moment to moment, or we could even say at the time we're taking refuge in Buddha, at that time, we cannot it's not like there's no greed, hate, and delusion, but we're not going to plummet into the depths of greed, hate, and delusion. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I think just to hear it on the surface, it just sounds like, oh, it's part of Indian mythology. You take refuge in Buddha and you can't fall into the lower realms. But I think there's some truth to we're no longer in these extreme versions of greed, hate, and delusion. It's not that they're not arising just by taking refuge in Buddha, but they're, we can't fall that far down. But also we're not completely free from samsaric cycle of the six realms either. It's just, but we are, if the more we keep taking refuge in Buddha, even in the more literal version of rebirth, we won't fall into these lower realms. Because actually this, I think the literal version of Indian rebirth is based on the psychological principle. You see, if we're extremely hateful and angry in this life, then that's you can end up in a literal hell realm. So whether it's literal or psychological, I think it's actually a great teaching about the benefit of taking refuge in the three treasures. Also, Dogen just comments and says here in one sentence or so, he says, the king took refuge in the three treasures and was born at, or maybe this is still the sutra. King took refuge in the three treasures and was born in a wealthy man's family. He left his household, which is shuke, like shuke tokudo, like leave home. He left his strong attachments and achieved the state beyond study, or the path of no more learning. I think this is referring to this in these five path model. In this way, the merit of taking refuge in the three treasures is immeasurable and boundless. So it kind of worked. He was born in a human realm. But there is also this teaching of the three motivations for taking refuge. Dogen doesn't comment here, but actually the lesser, the kind of lowest motivation for taking refuge in Buddha is to not be born in the lower realms, actually, and to be born in the upper realms. And so in a way, this story is about the kind of lower motivation. Even though it's a good one, it's valid and it's good, and of course no one wants to be born in the lower realms in extreme greed, hate, and delusion. So it's a valid reason for taking refuge in the three treasures. But the next best, the kind of like middle, so kind of lesser motivation, middle motivation, and greater motivation. The middle motivation from a Mahayana standpoint would be to realize complete liberation from suffering, be an arhat, right? Permanently free from suffering, never again reborn into any of the realms, the upper or lower, would be like a middling motivation. Not like you're necessarily going to, but that's why I'm wholeheartedly taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And as you might imagine, the greater motivation is to realize Buddhahood, the Mahayana Buddhahood, which is not just personal liberation from suffering, but having the infinite compassion and skillful means to like benefit beings endlessly. And all along the Bodhisattva path to Buddhahood, we're constantly vowing to keep coming back into these six realms in order to benefit beings, instead of escape as quickly as possible from this miserable... Even the God realm is miserable from an arhat's point of view, because the five signs of decay eventually appear. Their underarms start smelling eventually. Who would want that?
Just before deodorant.
Maybe like deodorant doesn't even work for when the God's signs of decay arise.
It's kind of like perspiration, yeah. It's
like going into that nursing home. No matter how hard those nurses scrub,
yeah,
it still has an odor.
That's true.
So I think that's a nice like teaching for to contemplate too, is like if we're really into taking refuge in Buddha, why? You know? And I think often, even it also can be seen as maybe our evolution of our own personal practice of Buddha Dharma, we often start the path, maybe almost always, we start from this motivation of, like, I'm really suffering. And I just want, I'm actually often involved in kind of like strong suffering based, and I have like strong patterns of greed, hate, and delusion. And I just want to be happy. Kind of like human. I just want to be a normal, happy human. Maybe even like really happy, godlike human. And that's maybe our kind of lesser motivation we begin. And then we start hearing these teachings. Or maybe we never get beyond that. That's good enough. But then we hear, actually, we start reading these sutras and there's a complete freedom from suffering. It's possible to be completely and permanently free. Now, we might not get to that point of saying, I really actually see that that could be possible. And I really want to throw my life into that project. If I want this complete liberation. What could be more valuable? I think then we get to that point. And that's a middling motivation. And then we hear about this Mahayana, vast Mahayana scope. Maybe we've been hearing about it all along, but we're like, this, you know, bodhisattva thing of being willing to just like be in this, all these confused suffering realms, like until everybody's free, like that's a little bit much. But maybe we warm up to it more and more, and we actually, at some point, like this bodhisattva vow, it sounds crazy. It sounds like a downsizing from the liberation path of the middling. Then we could just, why don't we just go for that? But our heart opens more and more, you know, through practice, and maybe we open this Mahayana heart and we're like, actually, I want to be a Buddha for the benefit of all beings. It's not just about my own liberation. And I would say, like, personally, my personal path, I think, actually does follow these kind of lesser, middling, and higher motivations. And in the strict sense of the kind of sort of Indian description of the bodhisattva path, so I think I'm somewhere kind of wavering sometimes between this kind of personal liberation path and the bodhisattva thing is just so, you know, beyond awesome and beyond comprehension in a way. It's like I can waver, be like, I don't know. It's just, if, you know, if I really take it literally, like, beings are numberless and I vow to save them, like, I don't mind saving a few. Arhats can save a lot of people. But saving all beings, that's the kind of greatest motivation. So I think that, for me, I take that teaching to heart about these three motivations.
The Bodhisattva sounds more generous, you know, than somebody who wants to just find the light and just...
Yeah, in a kind of general way, I think we could look at it as, it's kind of looking outside our own liberation, but in a more like traditional way, it's beyond just more generous. It's like, I'm willing to like give away all my body parts and everything to whatever it takes to free all beings endlessly. And it's kind of like hard to, I think even Steve Stuckey, I remember this talk he gave once at Green Gulch, where it stayed with me because I thought, this is hard. And he said, as I understand, this is my kind of memory of this talk, is if I understand this bodhisattva path, really, it's like we're really willing to like treat others, all sentient beings, kind of equal to ourselves, which would mean, in his reflecting on this, I should be willing to actually, the sutras talk about giving your body parts, actually, right? If you're ready to, you're really ready. And he said, I actually know that I could give one of my kidneys to another person and save their life, literally save a sentient being's life, and it wouldn't kill me. It wouldn't actually, you know, I could keep living. And so people do it quite often, and it's not that dangerous. But and I would probably do that for a loved one in my family, but would I do that for a stranger? There are strangers who need kidneys right now. Am I willing to give my kidney? And he said, I'm working on contemplating that. And I don't, to be honest, I confess, I don't feel like I'm quite ready to do that. And therefore, I'm not sure if I'm, you know, strictly speaking, fully like in this bodhisattva vow. So I think it's a good humble attitude.
One kitty, one eye.
Yeah, yeah, we hear these stories, right?
I'll give you a hand, but not my whole hand.
Yeah. Yeah, and my teacher Sokhmi Rinpoche, who I feel is this incredibly compassionate bodhisattva who's giving his life to benefit all beings, he also speaks and he said, you know, of course, I like to think of myself on this bodhisattva path. It's all about the Mahayana, but when it comes right down to it, those types of contemplations and am I really like willing to give everything for all beings? Like, I have doubts about that sometimes, and therefore I feel like I'm wavering between this kind of like, Hinayana and Mahayana. I'm like, really? You're wavering on the Mahayana? And I think it's just a nice, humble, confessional attitude of like, if we really take this Mahayana bodhisattva vow really seriously, it's like, it's incredible. It's like, beyond awesome. The greatest motivation to take refuge in the three treasures. So, the great collection of sutras says, the Maha Samnipata. I think this is now we're into Mahayana Sutra. Though, we've got all these dragon stories coming up. And dragons may be, since it's in the sutras, it may be a translation of Naga. It's kind of Indian version of dragons or Nagas. These water beings. When the world honored one was alive, 2,600,000,000 hungry dragons went to see him, all shedding tears like rain, and said, "We beg you to rescue us. World honored one of great compassion, upon reflection we realize that although we left home and entered Buddha Dharma in our past lives, because of various unwholesome deeds, or really unwholesome karma, we have remained in the three unwholesome realms, these three lower realms, hungry ghosts, hell and animal realm, for immeasurable eons. Then, due to other causes, we were born in the dragon realm, which I don't know if that's considered part of the animal realm, or is it its own kind of Indian mythological character realm. Actually, I don't know how they talk about Maharagas, Kimnaras, and Garudas in terms of the six realms. That would be an interesting question.
Is he talking about like realm in the same sense, or like,
yeah,
just like the home of the dragons?
Maybe it is actually like animal realm, but invisible animal realm. I don't know how they see this actually. Yeah, here it's just the realm of the, it's not one of the six realms, but the dragon realm, and have been suffering a great deal. The Buddha said to the dragons, "You should immediately take refuge in all three treasures and practice wholesomeness single-heartedly, or with one mind, single mind, one heart, one mind. As a result, you will be able to meet the final Buddha named," here it says Lochana Buddha, but actually it looks like it's Ruchika Buddha in Chinese, the last Buddha in this present Kalpa, this Bhadra Kalpa. And this is part of the, you know, Indian Buddha story. There's this Buddha named Ruchika. So basically take refuge. Actually, when it says take refuge in the three treasures here, it literally says receive the three treasures. And many places in this story, it's like the Jew of Jukai, we say receive the precepts. Here it's Jew Sambo, receive the three treasures. Which may...
Jukai means what?
Actually, Jukai, there's two two Japanese, Sino-Japanese ways of writing Jukai, and one of them means to receive the precepts, and there's another character, Ju, that means to confer or give the precepts. And it's interesting in the text, like Shogogenzo Jukai, there's a chapter called, which is, I think that one's receiving, but in the ceremony, in the Soto Zen manual of Jukai, it's conferring the precepts, because I think the ceremony is for the teacher, so this is the ceremony of how you give the precepts. But it's, they both sound the same, and the characters are almost identical. In Chinese, it's the same kind of radical character, but the one for give has the hand radical, interestingly. So there's receive, and then receive with a hand means give. Mm-hmm. Give or confer. So, but here it's the one character that means receive. And as what's that?
So kai means precepts.
And kai means precepts, a translation of shila. Shila in Sanskrit. Kai means precepts, yeah.
What's the Chinese for
that? Can't remember. Yeah. Can't remember. But a little Chinese lesson to throw in here about the ju of, which means to receive. That same character, it may seem strange, is used to translate vedana, one of the five skandhas, which is the feeling skandha. So, it's very strange, huh? So feeling, the way the Chinese wanted to capture this, the meaning of feeling, is receive, what we receive.
Is felt.
Is felt, yeah, what is felt is what is received, is what is felt, yeah. Mm. In terms of pleasant or unpleasant, is what is received. And it's received due to, like, our karma and the 12-fold chain. It's like feeling comes from, you know, we receive pleasant and unpleasant due to our activities, are the kind of cause, and the result that we receive is pleasant or unpleasant. So, but it sounds so different from feeling, right? There's probably other characters that mean feeling. That's a little completely irrelevant side note, but an interesting Dharma tidbit. So, in the future you will meet Ruchika Buddha, the last Buddha of this present Kalpa, and your sins or your faults will disappear during this Buddha's time. Upon hearing these words, all the dragons received and maintained the three treasures with utmost sincerity until their lives ended. Thus, when the Buddha rescued the dragons, he used no other methods. This is Dogen now, I think, speaking. When Buddha rescued the dragons, he used no other methods or techniques than just presenting the three treasures. I think he's saying they were these beings that are really suffering in this dramatic situation. He could have needed to teach like an entire long dragon sutra to them to, you know, help them. But it's very simple practice. That's how I hear it. No other methods or techniques. No meditation instructions. Just the three treasures. Although in their past lives these dragons had left home, Shuke, and received the three treasures, which is interesting, they had not only taken refuge in the three treasures, but they'd actually been ordained, right, and really took refuge in the three treasures in the past. But because of their unwholesome karma, they became hungry dragons, and there was no other way for the Buddha than to offer them refuge in the three treasures. So it gets back a little bit again to this issue of permanent. We could say until the path of seeing, which is this direct realization, kind of in the marrow of our bones, you might say, then even if we take refuge, even if we leave home and we're practicing so wholeheartedly, we can still fall into these, like, lower realms. I could say, well, isn't the lesser motivation for taking refuge to at least not be born in the lower realms, like a dragon realm? And I would say that is the motivation, but even if we're taking refuge many times, if we stop taking refuge, it doesn't mean that we're not going to fall again. So,
and then Yuan Wu makes points several times about that until that moment when mm-hmm. bucket falls through,
the bucket falls through.
That you know that the attainment is shaky.
Yeah.
Really solid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Until that moment of falling mm-hmm. through.
Mm-hmm.
Falling through completely, and I think you know, the great dying. I think is what I'm being pointed
out. Yeah.
You know that.
Yeah.
That has to take place in order mm-hmm. for that seeing to be.
Mm-hmm. And then also, and then there's still, of course, much work to be done for a long time of integration. But one could never stop practicing. That's the joy we can say. I vow to in my next lives find the Buddha Dharma again, because we're onto something here. But we might say, but we might not until this point. And then we could say, at this point, then our trust, we know that we will be able to find this again, because it's like, it's basically, you could say this point is recognizing our Buddha nature without a doubt, and then this, whatever confusion is like obscuring it, the Buddha nature is radiantly shining, and we know that we will find this again, because we will, as long as we're a sentient being, we will, this will be our nature, so it can't be lost. And it can't be lost. Yeah, our true nature can't ever be lost. But if we haven't clearly seen it yet, then we're not even sure what can or can't be lost. So, and I think we see people. We know people, in our Zen circles for years now, who are like super serious practitioners. They formally take refuge in Buddha. They receive the precepts. And they practice for a while, and they start fading away from. We shouldn't say necessarily that they're losing Buddhist practice or the true way or something, because it might be taking a different form. But I think there's also people who actually kind of just forget what's most important. Actually,
you heard the term retrogression.
Like retrogression.
So what are you doing?
Regression.
Well, you're doing the same thing, you know, like going through the motions, and then you start to decline. And I think that happens in practice.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. You go through the motion, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like.
Yep. So that's when we need to somehow, aim at the heart of it, right? And like remember what it's all based on in the first place. And if we've had moments of bodhicitta where we're really clear, like, I am totally on board 100% with this path, and we're maybe really out of touch with that, then how do we find it again? We need to kind of reinvigorate our bodhicitta. And I think we can, and as Dogen says in his essay on bodhicitta, which is our, you know, aspiration to practice endlessly for the benefit of all beings, he said bodhicitta's like, there's these three things that like, that once they're born don't come to fruition. Like a certain kind of fish egg that is quickly eaten by other fish, and some kind of like other like worm or some kind of being that only lives a very short time, and bodhicitta. In other words, you can have really deep aspiration, strong bodhicitta, but it's very, very fragile and easily lost, Dogen says. You have to nurture it and protect it like a precious, fragile, like a little baby, like our own eyes, you know. Baby bodhicitta.
Like
yeah, gnat. A gnat. Bodhicitta is kind of like a gnat. So I think refuge could be the same way. We could say like, we can take refuge in Buddha and feel some sense of it, but it can keep deepening and deepening to this point of no return. And we can lose it, and people can be deeply on the path and completely drop it and get pulled astray into another path. It may be also good. That's why I say, you don't want to say, we have the only way, Soto Zen Buddhism, or Buddha Dharma.
The Dharma that says it's the Dharma.
Yeah, the Dharma that says it's the Dharma, right. So there could be other beautiful ways of following the same path to complete freedom for the benefit of all beings. And we honor that as another expression of the three refuges in a different language, maybe, right? But then there's, I think, significant in our precept ceremony right after we recite the call and response, taking refuge in Buddha, and the ordainee receives the three refuges, and then the preceptor says something like, now you have, now Buddha is your teacher, do not be fooled by other ways. Do not be led into like other paths. Don't like now forget this and say, well, that was good, I did the Buddhist thing, now I'll try this one. Kind of like, there's other ways, or like bombarding us constantly, right? Especially like places like Santa Cruz in California. There's other way, spiritual ways, right? Like, check this one out, this one's better.
Yeah.
Super popular ones. There's more people in that one, so.
Paleo
that
one. Diet.
Yeah. Paleo diet. I take refuge in that. No, don't be fooled by other ways.
That line in a novel where he says, those who persist are most rare.
What's the line?
Those who persist are most rare.
Where is this from?
Yuan Wu.
Oh, those who persist are most rare, yes. Totally. So, and I think about this a lot, you know. I think about at our Zen center here, what lights people's Dharma candle, right? And how, what keeps people going? And, cause we do see people in a sangha here, very active and then kind of fade away. And like, what's missing? Where the Dharma candle is sputtering? Is there something special? And maybe in Zen we're always told, don't look for something special. It's something very ordinary practice, but we persist to forever and ever. We keep doing it, right? And maybe people who have a little thinking, like, well, mate, isn't something supposed to happen? I've been doing it for 5 years. And then nothing happens.
A big payoff,
maybe.
What comes to my mind is this idea of practicing it without... I just lost it. Without gaining something,
yeah.
That's like, keeping it fresh, keeping it alive. It's a bit of an art to keep it alive and not try to gain something.
Yeah, not try to gain something.
I'm trying to get to that level.
Mm-hmm. Yep. If we're striving too hard for that, then that will be discouraging and we might stop. But at the same time, then in the other extreme, I think, is if we really feel like, well, nothing, really, my life is just as much a mess as before, I think then we also give up.
Right.
So in a way, we are evolving. I think we have to feel like actually something is slowly opening, the flower is slowly opening, but yet we're not trying to grasp at like the fully bloomed flower either. So it's kind of a middle way, maybe. We have to see something happening, or we stop. But if we grasp too much happening, we think something more should be happening, then we also stop. So are we willing to gradually open?
I think it's so hard in our culture.
Yeah,
it's so hard.
Well, it's a fast food culture.
Really because we haven't yet,
mm-hmm.
and we all know what it is. You know. And what our culture is like, and how, you know, things aren't valued, right? I mean,
and quick results we're into.
And, you know, quick results, and there's always something new and better, more interesting, and that's built into everything in our American culture, certainly, and perhaps a little wider, certainly in American culture. I think it's very hard in this culture, in this place and time.
Yeah. Even this, that very point, even in regards to how we evolve and present Zen practice in America, I think is a big ongoing question. I think for many, many people involved in Zen in this country, and there's the one approach of, because we're such a fast-paced, ever-changing culture, we have to keep changing the practice to make it more palatable and accessible to more people, right, is one approach. And then the other approach is, you know, that's just buying into our... this diluted culture. Let's just keep doing the same simple thing. It's worked for thousands of years, and it without changing too much, actually. But people get bored with it. It's not flashy enough. So
it's not sexy.
Yeah, Zen, not sexy. Maybe in the '60s it was, because it was new. It was new and unusual.
Right.
Now it's been going to. It's almost too mainstream now.
Right.
Well, these are big questions, I think.
And, you know, it's, you know, you see the word Zen used in all kinds of bizarre and
sure.
and totally deluded ways.
Yeah.
And you know, not the use of being like a hurt or lessened or diminished in any way. Zen itself is not something that can be diminished, but in terms of people's many people's kind of casual relationship to the word Zen, it becomes just one more product.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's you know Zen makeup and you know Zen clothes and
this whole
kind of ridiculous way of marketing that sort of diminishes everything it touches in a way, you know, including something like
that. And just on the SCBA, the Soto Zen Buddhist Association email conversations. Did you read this recently? There's just in the last week, this very topic was coming up. People were posting various photos of Zen stores and Zen perfumes and all these places that Zen gets used. There's
one in town, yeah.
Really?
The Zen Trading Company.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
East Avenue.
Uh-huh.
They sell little Japanese sand trays that you can make designs in.
Yeah.
Yep.
And vases that have a Japanese...
I was giving massages at Zazen in San Francisco.
Yeah.
It's a good place. It's a good guy who owns it and everything.
What happens, you know, is that people buy these things and they think if they have some kind of made contact with what Zen is.
Yeah. I think it's this email conversation started with there was a, I think, New York Times video yoga classes is this new thing, and this yoga instructor was talking about if you want to have if you want to Zen out, this is this word Zen out, and somebody picked up on it, like, look how they're using this, and if you want to have a Zen, this is a good Zen moment. And and then the teachers were, some people were kind of upset, actually, in this email conversation. Some of the Zen teachers were like, this is really a shame what's happening to Zen. And the other teacher said, it doesn't matter because the actual true Zen is just going to keep going. And in a couple hundred years, these stores won't exist anymore. And it'll find its way. It doesn't matter. There's nothing we have to protect.
That's true. The article... a few months ago about Google giving starting sort of Zen classes, and the point of it was to make people more productive, to get ahead, by being more cool and more with it and more focused on work.
Yeah,
by taking these Zen classes, that you could be so that you get. So you get bonuses, you would get advancement, and use the methods of meditation to improve your career.
Yeah.
I think that's all too
important. So that's why Dogen's as our Zen teachers, yes.
Well, Les Kay went into all of those places and taught mindfulness.
I know.
It's just a different aspect.
So Dogen, as a Zen teacher, actually says, let's take refuge in the three treasures, right? At the beginning of the essay, he said the authentic transmission of the Buddhas and Zen ancestors is devotion to the three treasures. So this is like our... what is Zen again? Oh, yeah. It's taking refuge in the three treasures. It's basically just Buddha Dharma. So no other methods were needed to help these dragons be free from their suffering. Know that the merit of taking refuge in the three treasures is venerable, unsurpassable, inconceivable, and profound. The World Honored One already proved this, or verified and knew this, you could say. Sentient beings should receive them with trust. Without having the dragons chant the names of the Buddhas in the 10 directions, the World Honored One just encouraged them to take refuge in the three treasures. who can fathom the depth of his intention? Thus, sentient beings nowadays should immediately take refuge in the three treasures instead of chanting various Buddha's names. Do not miss this great merit through stupidity and ignorance. So we might say that Dogen here is making a little critique of like the Pure Land school.
Nietzsche.
Yeah, which I think we could say, if we're the authentic practitioners of the Pure Land school, where their main practice is chanting the names of Buddhas, if they're actually taking refuge in the three treasures and doing that, the chanting the name of Buddha as a form of taking refuge, then that's fine. But Dogen here and elsewhere critiques those who are kind of missing the point. Well, if we just repeat this name over and over again, that's enough. We'll be born in Amitabha's Pure Land. So it's not an inherent critique of Pure Land school. We're just, if we miss the point and just think we can do some practice without refuge. We might say Zen too. If Zen is just a concentration technique to be really present and concentrated and still without refuge in the three treasures, we still might say that, then it's missing the point of Dogen's Zen. Because the authentic transmission of the Buddhas and ancestors is devotion to the three treasures. So, one more class on this essay. No?
Is this the fifth one?
I think this is the fifth. Is that right?
Yeah.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Fourth.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe we keep remembering over and over because it's so easily lost, the heart of the practice. And how nice that Dogen gives us all these different versions of three treasures. So if we don't like one, we can pick up another. May all beings find their true, secure, safe refuge. Find peace, compassion, and freedom. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.